Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review. And this time it's just me by myself, no Juliana this time, although I have got some good feedback about people enjoying having someone else contributing to the podcast, especially with these more classic books. The idea being, though, that the books that me and Juliana review together, read and review together, kind of more the kind of classic science fiction. Or maybe not like classics as in like old books, but you know, kind of highly regarded books. And also, it seems to be turning into more of a series where if there's a movie of the book as well, we'll watch the movie and kind of review it along with it. And so we've decided as the next duo podcast recording, we're going to do Solaris again. It hasn't been long since I reviewed Solaris, but I listened to the audiobook version, so I'm also going to read another translation, the original English translation, and we're going to watch one or two of the movies of Solaris as well, and have a good Solaris discussion, loads of spoilers, all that kind of stuff. But for now, let's get on to this solo podcast. The book that I'm going to be reviewing, actually, to be honest, I did read this quite a few weeks ago. I listened to the audiobook quite a few weeks ago. But like I say, because I've been doing these other podcasts with Juliana, I haven't really got around to doing it. But now I'm on a work trip and I've not got very much to do on this work trip. In fact, I've got lots and lots of stuff to do on this work trip, but I have a bit more time to myself rather than when I'm at home. And so, yeah, here we go. This book is called Falling Free. It's a novel from the Vorkosigan saga, written by Louis McMaster Bejold. I guess it's Louis McMaster Bejold, which I'm getting this information directly here from the Wikipedia page on this thing. It was first published as four installments in Analog from December 1987 to February 1988. And it won the Nebula Award for Best Novel in 1988. Yeah, so I listened to it as an audiobook. It was like 8.5 or 9 hours long, an audiobook, and I guess it's about, it says here, 300 pages from in the original paper book. Now, the reason I read this is because the Vorkosigan series, or saga, or whatever it's called, is one of the most recommended series, or like kind of any kind of books, really. Loads of people said, oh, you should read it, it's really good. And other people say, when I've listened to or read these other kind of military science fiction, space opera kind of books, people have said, "Oh yeah, you didn't like Honor Harrington, and you didn't like what is it, the Starship Mutiny or whatever it was called." That series, you didn't like them, big rants about those ones. Hey, but you're really like this. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll give it a go. But then I realized, of course, one of the things that I don't like about those long series is that they are long series, and I'm, you know, you start at the beginning, and you know, it's all like, okay, there's a captain, and there's a ship, and there's a thing, and you know, it feels quite samey to me. And then you go, well, there's no tension in that first book because you know that they're probably going to get promoted at the end of it, and then there's the next book, and then there's the next book, and then the next book, and you know, this whole thing. And I was thinking, well, where's the interest in that? You know, is there going to be like a lot of character development? The thing is that you like about these military science fiction, like Ender's Game, is that you start off with a kid and you end up with a war hero. And these books often start off with a you know, with someone who is already like a really good and really competent, and then kind of goes on from there. You know, this is the kind of thing that I was kind of expecting going into this Vorkosigan series or saga. But of course, I didn't really know where to begin. And so I looked around, and I was like, what's the first book? And there seems to be like a few different ways of reading this. So I just Googled, actually. I says, reading order of Vorkosigan saga. And there seems to be a few different ways to do it. One is, of course, reading the books in the order that they were written and published. And the other order is, of course, going with the internal, you know, the internal chronological order. So I found these different bits and pieces, and even on Bujold herself, writing on the subject, she kind of leaves it open. She says, I don't number the books because, you know, theoretically you can just pick up any book, and even if you've not read any of the other books before, you can just read it and you'll be able to read it and enjoy it and understand everything that's going on, and there won't be massive spoilers in one book for another. So that was one thing. And the other thing was to do is actually just to read it chronologically. And I thought, well, Falling Free seems to be a novel which kind of stands out by itself. and isn't kind of in that main storyline. And it can be the first one that you read going internal chronology kind of style. So I thought, well, I'll just start with that and then go across onto, like, in the order that they're published, and see how it works in that way. And so, like I said before, I was kind of expecting... oh, by the way, if you think I'm doing it wrong, you can email me, but it's already too late. It's already too late. I've already read this book before I've read the others, but we'll see how it goes. So what I expected was this military science fiction with space battles and someone called Miles Vorkosigan, because he seems to be the main character in all of these books. And it turns out there wasn't a single Miles Vorkosigan or any kind of Vorkosigan, anybody from that kind of, like, the dynasty that I guess is the Vorkosigan dynasty. This is what I, you know, just know from picking stuff up by reading about this series or listening to people talking about it on podcasts and stuff. So yeah, there was nobody to really think, ah, well, in the next book, this person that, you know, they're a cadet in this book and they're going to go on and become an ensign in the next book, or a midshipman in the next book, and then in the captain in the next book. You know, there was never any of those failings, because it's not military science fiction at all. This is Falling Free. So I didn't get any kind of military science fiction, but I did get kind of this homage to, or almost a pastiche in some ways, of, like, Golden Age science fiction. It feels very very much like Asimov, but probably even more like a Heinlein novel, in that, like, the main hero is a technician, and the administrator, kind of bean counter guy, is the villain. And, you know, it takes place in space, and there's rockets and, buzzing around in that way. There's some, like, Moon is a Harsh Mistress style kind of freedom-fighting rebellion. Hey, let's take back our freedom. Yeah, that kind of stuff. That's what I wasn't expecting that, but I got it. And because I quite enjoy that kind of style of science fiction, I thoroughly enjoyed this book. Also, there's something that I noticed. It's got this weird kind of nostalgia for that. But now if you watch Back to the Future, the movie Back to the Future, which was released in, I'm guessing, like, 84, 85, that movie, I guess at the time, was very popular because it had this massive nostalgia for the past, a massive nostalgia for the 1950s, which was 30 years before the movie was set and 30 years before the movie was made. And, in the same way that kind of Grease had that same... that same kind of nostalgia for the hairstyle and the music and all that kind of stuff. I say the hairstyle. I wasn't around in the 50s, so I'm not quite sure what we're meant to be nostalgic about that. But there's a lot to be nostalgic about. But then you watch Back to the Future now, and you get this extra layer of nostalgia. You get this 80s nostalgia, because we're now almost 30 years on from the mid 1980s, which was also 30 years on from the mid 1950s. And so you get these, like, two styles of nostalgia. You get nostalgia for the 50s and nostalgia for the 80s, but then there's, like, this third layer of nostalgia on top of it, which is, like, nostalgia for what nostalgia used to be in the 1980s. And that nostalgia used to be like almost completely uncynical. There wasn't any irony. I mean, I guess there was some cynicism and irony, but, you know, the nostalgia kind of felt like a pure nostalgia, because you go, well, 1950s, well, of course, it was all good, and, you know, jets, liners were coming along, and there was technology, and it was prosperous and stuff, all that kind of stuff. And then now that we're nostalgic for the 80s, it's sort of like, yeah, well, the fashion was actually really bad and the music was really bad, but we're going to be nostalgic for the 80s music even though it was really bad. You know, there's not that kind of, hey, yeah, the birth of rock and roll in the 80s. It's like, yeah, disco, yeah, you know. So these were nostalgic for 80s, 50s nostalgia in a way. Anyway, so that's what I kind of felt a little bit with when I was reading Falling Free. And I kind of see why it won the Nebula Award in the 1980s, because it is like a love letter to Golden Age science fiction, and yet it includes a lot more than that. Along with the descriptions of, you know, welding and zero gravity welding and technical work in space, and, you know, the kind of thing that you'd expect from a 1950s Heinlein novel, you get, like, a lot of material that feels very kind of 80s, because you've got this, this almost I want to say like the space opera feels much more 80s. The hard science fiction kind of elements feel a little bit more 80s. But then there's the kind of sociological side of the science fiction, which feels to me very 80s. Although it's not something I can put my finger on. It's because, yeah, well, this is a story about, people... It has a lot of the same elements as your kind of golden age science fiction, but I guess like just the inflection, just the way that it looks at it is a little bit more informed by the 80s, and all kind of like the new wave stuff which was happening in the 1960s and 70s. It feels a lot more influenced by that kind of. And again, like I say, it's very difficult to put my finger on it, but that's the kind of feeling that I get, that I get this 80s. Like 80s science fiction nostalgia looking back now from the 2013 or whatever, not 2013. So also, like I said, about the kind of cynicism or irony kind of thing, it has a lot of that kind of stuff missing in a way. A lot of stuff, the science fiction of the last few decades, there were computers in this novel, but there's no big artificial intelligence. There's no, there's nobody looking around going, hey, when is the singularity going to happen? And I don't remember any artificial intelligence. Again, I admit there might have been, but I really don't know. And there's no, there's no internet or and there's no cyberpunk or steampunk or any kind of punk at all. There's that kind of I kind of got this little nostalgia for how science fiction used to be in the 1980s when it wasn't always about, hey, well, we're just connecting this network and then the singularity, blah blah blah. Which we'll have to see. Anyway, so the world that this book is set in is, pretty, like I say, pretty basic space opera kind of stuff. You've got, got these worlds and the systems and the routes between the systems, and you need a special ship to get between them with some special technology which hasn't been invented yet. And these pilots need to have, like, these implants in their head. And I always like the idea of having special pilots. Getting between the stars is very difficult, which I guess has been done, like, in Dune. You have the navigators and a lot of Heinlein books. There's the ones where you get the people with the kind of special mental abilities which can go and control the ships. I can't think of one, but like the time, is it Time for the Stars or something like that? They do that kind of stuff. And a few of the Heinlein novels do that. Of course, this is sort of like implanted with technology rather than any kind of, psi ability or telepresence kind of ability, which seemed to be a little bit more in like the 1950s and 1960s, where you could still have this more mystical kind of stuff right there in the science fiction and people wouldn't mind it. By the time you get to the 80s, a lot of that kind of stuff has gone again. You don't get people who are just, I guess you do in a way, you get these dragon books where people are telepathic, but not so much in the science fiction. And of course, there's companies, these kind of pan-galactic companies, which control entire systems or entire whole planets. Galactech, which is the main technology company, which is sort of like, again, that's another thing from the 1980s where you get these corporations controlling entire cities. It reminds me of a bit of the... was it in RoboCop? I can't remember the name of that. Or in Aliens, where you get these, was it the Wayland Corporation? These big things, they just control entire people, entire stations, and you kind of sign your life over to them, which feels quite like that. So, yeah, Galactech has this whole planet for 100 years, a bit like, the British Empire with taking Hong Kong, and we've got it for 100 years, and we're going to have to give it back at some point. But, and all the action takes place around this one planet, which I can't remember the name of, and there's this huge orbital space station. What's so special about the space station? Well, on the space station, the space station isn't spinning, and our main character, who's called Leo Graffi, he floats up towards it at the beginning. They say, well, why is it not spinning? Well, that's not very good. You have to have a spinning space station, because if a spinning space station isn't spinning, or if the space station isn't spinning, it means there's no gravity, and it means that you can't work on board, and people's bones atrophy, and their muscles waste away, and it's very difficult, and people get sick, and all that kind of stuff. And of course, he arrives on the ship and he finds that it's not spinning for a reason, because it's a breeding center for a kind of people genetically modified humans called quaddies, which have pretty much have like two sets of arms, or to put it another way, their legs aren't legs, they're kind of another set of arms with hands on the end. And this is, I've read this kind of thing a few times before, you know, the whole idea, oh, well, apes will be better in space because they've got four pairs of hands. No, not four pairs of hands. They've got two pairs of hands, four hands, and there's, I can't remember the name of the other... there's another science fiction, is it Eon or Eternity or whoever writes that, I can't remember, but I remember that same idea coming up there where these aliens come down and kind of like modify humans in a way, and some of them are modified to have extra hands where their feet would be. So these quaddies, as they're called in this book, they've been, there's a thousand of them on this spaceship, and they've been bred to work in space, to be able to do, to build space stations and build spaceships, and generally be able to stay in space for long times without having to spin space stations, which means you can, they can be built, the space stations can, I think they can be built weaker, or that, you know, they don't have to be spinning, so they don't have to hold themselves together under the, like, the spinning pressures. There's yeah, it's just generally a lot easier, and the idea being that they do this it's meant to be experimental, but the whole thing seems to be a bit like a tax write-off. It's like, yes, we can do this and develop the technology and do all this kind of stuff out here in this place, and genetic engineering is generally illegal, but we'll be able to do it because we own this planet, and the whole thing is like this corporate tax write-off, and in the future it may or may not give money, get us money back, but for now it's a good way to do it. And of course, as this book goes along, suddenly, oops, artificial gravity is invented or discovered or something. And suddenly, like, well, quaddies aren't needed anymore. And so the whole thing is like, well, what will happen to the thousand quaddies on the ship? They're not classed as human. They're kind of slave labor. They're not being paid or anything like that. And they're not, like I say, they're not human. They're classed, I think, as like experimental tissue cultures or human tissue cultures. So their legal status is very you know, ambiguous, and what are they going to do about it? And that's like the main tension, the main conflict in this book. Well, what are we going to do? What's going to happen here? And of course, you can kind of guess, and I've kind of given it away a little bit what happens. They're gonna get out of it. They're gonna fight for their independence in some way, or fight for their human rights, even though they're not technically, they're not baseline humans, and in all of the paperwork, they're not classed as humans. So yeah, the main character in the book, the main human character that we follow anyway, is a guy called Leo Graf, and he is our big-hearted technician. He's there to teach the quaddies how to weld in zero gravity, but he does become some kind of leader in their fight back against the man. The other human characters are interesting enough. There's a pilot called Ty, who I actually quite liked. Seemed to be quite pragmatic about his situation that he's in. I can't actually remember the names of all of the characters. I think Banada is a Banada something guy. I just remember is that if your name has got two negative things, like an adder, which is a snake, and ban, it means you're not allowed to do something. Ban adder. Guess he's going to be the bad guy. But again, maybe I just, when I heard that name, maybe he's not the guy I'm thinking of. Maybe I've matched that name up somewhere else. Anyway, he's the guy who is like, I am the guy who is controlling everything here, rah, rah, rah. So he's the bad guy. And then you've got the kind of, I think, is it Minchenko? There's a doctor, but maybe he's not the right doctor. Again, too long ago that I read this book. You get some interesting human characters, but not, I say, they're interesting is like what they do is interesting, but who they are isn't interesting. It's like, well, I am the doctor, and I am good because I'm the doctor, and I'm bad because I'm the sociologist, and I'm okay because I'm a technician, and I'm bad because I'm the administrator, and I'm good because I like the quaddies, and I'm bad because I'm a businessman. You know, it's that kind of, quite basic, basic characterizations, or like not a lot of depth there to any of them. And then, of course, you've got the quaddies. Now, most of the quaddies, they might as well be unnamed. There's really only three quaddies which do anything at all. Of course, a lot of quaddies are heroes, but we don't follow them, and we don't really follow their stories. But there are three of them. You've got Tony, who is the father of the first ever baby Quaddy, and Claire, who is the mother of the first ever baby Quaddy. And in the first part of the book, it's like they're going, well, we don't want to be Quaddies anymore, we want to get out of here. And so they go on a little adventure when they try and escape the space station and try and make a life of their own, which I actually really quite like that story. But then they kind of fade into the background, and another Quaddy, who you think at the beginning is just going to be like a supporting character, becomes more and more a main character. And yet I can't really think, she does interesting stuff. She goes off and she's the leader in this way, and she's like, oh, this is really interesting. But yeah, Silver has a lot of talents. At the first, you think, well, her talents are going to be sexy fun time talents, but she does break out of that role and become a lot more independent in a way. But yet still, you've got this weird kind of thing that she is like, oh, we're going to have all these Quaddies. But this one is going to be a sex object. But it's okay that she's got a sex object, because she's good at other stuff as well. And while you realize that a lot of these female Quaddies, they're not just for breeding, you know, it makes it very clear that, yeah, they're to work, and when you have a baby, and then the next day you're back on the job again. So I did find it a little bit weird about the romantic attachments between, I think she's, I can't even remember her whole, but she seems to come off as like 16 or 17 or 18 years old and getting involved with much older guys. But again, that I could say, oh, I don't like that. But no, I think it works within the story. But there is another romantic attachment which takes place, which I didn't really think it was that appropriate. It's just like, hey, and now as a prize for helping out the Quaddies, you human, you get a female Quaddy just for you. You're like, well, are females, are they meant to be prizes? Maybe they are, I don't know. I mean, in this book, I don't think so. Moving on to the science and technology, as mentioned, a lot of the you get a lot of this kind of Heinlein kind of, yes, we're going to get out of it by using our brain and using our slide rules and using our on the job experience and knowing how to weld stuff and being able to fix this pipe to that pipe, and that's going to be the thing that saves the day in the end. It's not going to be military prowess, and it's going to be, you know, like diplomatic stuff as well. You know, you're going to be able to talk to the right people and do the right things at the right time, and you're going to be able to lie really well and say you're going to do one thing and then go off and do another thing. But again, most of the hey, are we going to get out, you know, like say the tension in like, is it going to work, isn't like how many it's a bit weird. It's not like how many people are going to die, how many people do we kill, how big is the explosion going to have to be to get to the end of this book and achieve our goal. Is much more like, hey, how well is this welding going to go, and you know, we're going to do this zero gravity heavy manufacturing using ice and explosives. You know, like the only explosives that take place in this is when they're actually creating something, building something, rather than blowing something up, which is a refreshing change, especially when I went into this book expecting blowing up people as a solution to the problem, rather than exploding cool alloys or whatever's going on. I can't remember. I quite enjoyed a lot of that. But yeah, like I say, it's not about the space battles. I think one person gets shot in the book. Oh, maybe more people get shot. Again, I don't want to do spoilers. Yes, there is tension, but it's sort of like, you know, because the book is set up, you know, in sort of like, here are the Quaddies, and now they're going to explain. Unfortunately, it's kind of hard to believe that they won't win out in the end. And maybe that kind of lack of tension is based on readers already knowing the future, because this is a kind of a prequel-style book, and maybe we know that the Quaddies are all good, and we know that the Quaddies have, you know, won their freedom. So, yeah, it's not so much about if they win or not, but how they do so. Moving on to the writing style, it's, you know, pretty good. There's quite a lot, I quite like the conversations, you know, the dialogue is quite fun. Everything is very, like, kind of competently done, you know, in the same way that Heinlein writes, that when he writes about something, you're never really lost, or you're never understanding you're never not understanding what's going on, but there's not a lot of flashiness. I think my main problem is with the characters. You know, I liked all of them, but nothing more than kind of liking them. There's not a lot to sink my teeth into. And the narrator, because I listen to it as an audiobook, is Grover Gardner. And you really can't go wrong with Grover Gardner. He's a very prolific narrator, and I can see why. Because he's very good. I can't think of all the other books that I've listened to of Grover Gardner doing the narration, but he does a lot of this kind of stuff as well, and does a great job here. Also, while I'm talking about Audible, if you want to support the podcast, you can go along to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and there you can actually start a free trial of Audible. What you do, you can sign up. You don't have to pay anything or anything like that, but you can sign up for a trial, and you can get a free audiobook for you to download and listen to. I think you've got 14 days, or is it 30 days? I can't remember exactly what the deal is at the moment, but check it out, and you can get a book, and you can listen to this book falling free. If you download this, you can listen to this book. It's only 8.5 hours or so. I managed to listen through all of it in, I think, 2 or 2.5 days or something, and I was finished up with it, and it's very enjoyable. So check out this book, or check out any of these other books that I've read and recommended recently, and then you can choose from 100,000 different audiobooks, and then if you continue on past the trial, what you do is you pay a certain amount of money per month and you get Audible credits. I have a platinum account, which means I get 2 credits a month, or you can just sign up for the normal gold account or the standard account, and you get 1 credit per month, 1 audiobook per month, and it's way cheaper to do it this way, because so often these audiobooks, especially the longer ones, if you buy them on CD, or if you buy them from iTunes, or if you just buy them from Audible without having a subscription, you're going to be paying like $30-$40 just for one audiobook. Whereas if you have a subscription, I think it works out for me, once I translate it into euros, about €8 per book. And that's about as much as I'm going to pay for like a normal book. And in this way, I get someone to read it for me. So I do recommend signing up for an Audible account. It's how I get through most of the books I'm reading at the moment, or science fiction books. I'm reading lots of paper books, but none of them are fiction. And so they don't really come up here on this podcast at all. So check it out, SFBRP. Oh, no. Not SFBRP. If you go to sfbrp.com, you'll be able to find a link, and that link is audibletrial.com/SFBRP. So thanks a lot to Audible for their support of the podcast. Anyway, so moving on to the final section, which is the themes. There seems to be two like basic themes in this book. Of course, first of all, is like, oh, slavery bad, you know, who owns slave? And the whole idea of like, well, who owns, if a slave is a slave, but if they're not quite human, you know, who owns this genetically modified substance, you know, as they say, it's sort of like, yes, it's they're not people, they're tissue, they're you know, was it medical, experimental, genetically modified, you know, muscle tissue or laboratory growth or whatever they call it, you know, and who's responsible for that. And I actually really do enjoy, I really enjoyed the exploration of this, not just from like, oh yeah, slavery is bad, but all of the ways that these corporations were like trying to keep control and trying to keep, you know, trying to keep these people bound up. You know, the falling free isn't just like, oh, I'm falling in zero gravity. No, it's sort of like, you know, you're kind of, well, you know, are you free? No, you're not free. And if you are free, what's going to happen to you once you're free? Well, you're not going to have anyone control of you. You're not going to have anyone holding on to you, and you're going to be falling. And where are you going to land? You know, that's a very, you know, it's a very kind of like, well, duh, kind of explanation of the title of Falling Free. But it's all there. I really enjoyed the exploration of like, well, okay, we're going to have 1,000 quaddies on a ship. Well, how are we going to keep them in line? Well, we own them and they're not going to get paid. And, you know, the beginning people, some of these quaddies are like, oh, well, what's money? Well, how do I earn money? And the reason they don't understand all of this kind of thing is because when they've been brought up, when they've, all of their education has been focused around, you know, well, how to work in space, like all the children's books are like, hey, and there was Billy the Welder and Sammy the, you know, space plant technician, and there was Sandra and she looked after the hydroponics, you know, and they're all these books, and I think there's one of the only robots that are mentioned in the book is actually in the children's book that they're reading, and it's like, yes, and this robot did this and he looked after himself and did this job. And the history that they learn is like, well, it's not like, you know, in normal history books they're going to spend, you know, 50 pages talking about the glorious revolution, and then spend, you know, like a page at the beginning talking about what it was like before the revolution, a page on the end what it was like after. And it says, well, our history books, they have the one page at the beginning about the revolution, and then 50 pages about, and after the revolution, they went off and did this, and they built this bridge, and did this technological thing, and then did science over here, and they did agriculture over here, and then built this space station over here. And which brings to mind, like, the idea of, like, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but the idea that happens in these Eastern Bloc countries, like, and now for the glory of I guess it's the same as North Korea, now for the glory of North Korea, we're talking about our space program and talking about this and that and this, you know, the kind of revolution is of course part of it there, but one of the big things is about, and now we've built this skyscraper. Oh, we haven't finished the skyscraper, it's the world's tallest hotel, and we didn't finish it. Oh, and now 30 years later we're gonna finish it. And it's sort of like, you know, the technological failures are kind of swept under the rug, as you can see on these kind of things, but they succeed at, yes, these are now national triumphs, and this is what we want to do, science and technology, blah blah blah. Whereas in America, in a free country, the history is all like, yes, and the Civil War and the War of Independence, and then yes, and Martin Luther King gave this speech and blah blah blah, like that. You know, it's the history is very much about the people and the progressively more freedom of the people rather than the technological and other achievements, although you get that kind of stuff as well. Maybe that's a good thing to think about, and, you know, as you go on, maybe as you get people lose freedoms more and more, maybe that can be a study of, like, you know, you can check out, like, the education and news reporting as you go through a country, and the more they start talking about technological achievements, the less freedom the people have. I'm not sure if that holds true, but that could be an interesting way to do it. And I guess the other main theme of this book is the whole, well, what is it to be human? Except these people aren't human, but you do get a lot of the same kind of questions as, like, well, what is it to be free? What is it to be have free will? What is it, blah, 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 which doesn't really go directly into the slavery and lack of freedom. But I did find this whole thing interesting, you know, sort of like, well, is freedom just having free will? And if you don't have free will, are you freedom or not? Or like, even being able to understand the concept of free will. If you understand the concept of free will, or let me put it this way, is it possible to not understand the concept of free will and still have free will? Or, in the other way, is it possible to not understand the concept of free will and still have free will? I don't know. That's just something that this book kind of came up with me, because these people are like, oh, well, I really want a baby. Oh, I should have a baby. I should have a baby. And then it's like, wait a second, am I free not to have a baby? And then suddenly the having, knowing that you have a choice to have a baby or not, I don't know, maybe I'm just waffling here, but there's some stuff, there's the different things that come up in this thing. And also the other thing that I really like about this book, which is, I think, a direct response to something like the moon is a harsh mistress, is something I mentioned before, and that is, like, you know, uprisings or freedom fighting doesn't have to be violent. And you think, well, no, it doesn't. And I found it interesting that this book was, I think, published, let me just check here, do I have the thing? Yeah, so it was published in 1987, 1988, and because it's been a while since I read the book, I actually opened up the Amazon page for it, and decided to have a look at just a few reviews, just to remind me of some stuff to talk about, and also to see if I could remember the names of some of these characters, and looking at other people's reviews, because it's often like, oh, and this character does this, and this character does this. And it seemed like a few people who didn't like it was just saying, oh, well, there wasn't enough tension. There was only one, like, nobody got shot, nobody died. You can't have a revolution without anybody dying. You can't have a, like, freedom fighting. People have got to fight for it. People have got to sacrifice for it. And I was just looking at this going, well, yeah, if you think it has to be, if you think that the only way for people to gain freedom is in these, you know, bloody revolutions. And it's just like, well, actually, I've been to places in the world where they've had these bloody revolutions, and they're not that you know, that bit of their history is never that. It's not like, oh, yes, and everyone gave their lives for it, and we all really like that. Of course, you can like the outcome, but, like, nobody likes the fact that the museum burned down. Nobody likes the fact that you know, all the shops were ransacked. You know, nobody likes the fact that, you know, there was ethnic cleansing. Nobody likes all of those kind of things. So why, you know, why glorify that when... And this is what I find interesting about it, sort of like, hey, well, what about the fall of the Berlin Wall? What about that whole, you know, the whole perestroika, glasnost kind of thing? You know, it doesn't have to be, there doesn't have to be bloody revolutions in every single country. Berlin, the Berlin Wall fell, not a single shot. Nobody died at all. Romania, well, you know, they cleared some people out by some gunshots to the head. You know, you get these different, you know, it gets different sliding scale. And I think this book was at the time very optimistic about the outcome or the possible outcomes and ways that a revolution or, you know, a freedom fight could happen. And it was kind of borne out by what happened in Berlin. Funny news about the Berlin Wall. I noticed there's the Berlin Wall fell and David Hasselhoff did a concert and was like, yay, looking for freedom, everything like that. And that was, you know, it's a source of much comedy and kind of like shaking of heads here in Berlin. Now there's a part of the Berlin Wall called the East Side Gallery, and there's people trying to do some development, and lots of people in Berlin, because it's one of the final little bits of the Berlin Wall that's left over, people say, no, we should keep it. You know, they can't just knock down all that history, man. We've got to keep some stuff around. It's a gallery, it's an art gallery, it shows what the Berlin Wall was like. And and I think today, Sunday the 17th of March, David Hasselhoff is going to be doing a concert there now to save the Berlin Wall, to stop the Berlin Wall being knocked down. So I really like it that now we can, like, well, I'm talking back a bit more about this kind of 80s nostalgia, now we can actually go along and have a very kind of postmodern kind of view of the Berlin Wall protest, where we actually are now protesting the opposite. No, we want to save the Berlin Wall, and we're going to get David Hasselhoff back along. So we've got that whole kind of, I wouldn't say cynical, but yeah, very strange, ironic 80s nostalgia going on there, right there in Berlin. Anyway, I think that's all I have to... Oh, yeah, and I've made one more note. Yeah, instead of being violent, I think I like it how one of the main bits of tension and one of the main conflicts in this book is, like, will the doctor convince his wife to come along or not? And you're like, oh, well, what's he going to do if his wife doesn't want to, you know, doesn't want to, you know, help with the freedom fight and go on this mission? I quite like that style of... that style of conflict resolution. Anyway, I'm going to give this, it's a solid book. It's not perfect. I think if the characters were a little bit more interesting, I'd rate it a bit highly. And if it wasn't really predictable, like it starts off and you're like, well, I know what's going to happen with this. And it gets this point where I was thinking, well, is this person, is our main character, is he going to decide to do this or this? And it's like, well, it'll be really, really interesting if he decides to go in this way, but he'll probably go in the other way. But it'll be really interesting, it'll be fascinating if he doesn't. And which side is he going to go on? But he'll probably go in this way. And then, of course, he goes in the way that you know he's going to go, probably go. And all that kind of interesting storyline which could have led... like into like a fascinating book if Bujold had just kind of explored that for, you know, another 50 pages of like trying to keep it back again. But no, it seems to be at any point like the good guys do what the good guys do, the bad guys do what the bad guys are going to do, and it plays out. I'm not saying it plays out in an obvious way, because I really like the like some of the twists and turns that take place, but the overall line of the plot is pretty predictable. So I'm going to give this book 3.5 stars, which is very good, considering I was half expecting to do a rant about how I don't like military science fiction, but I was given almost the opposite of what I was expecting with this. So I have already the next book in the series, or maybe the first book in the series. Let me just bring up my iTunes here and click on the books thing. Because I can't remember the name of this. So I've just read Falling Free, and I have Shards of Honor. And Shards of Honor, I think, is the first book that was written. Oh, I could have actually just looked at the Wikipedia page here. Shards of Honor from 1986, which was written a few years before Falling Free. I already have that as an audiobook because this book, not really in the main Vorkosigan saga timeline, it falls outside of it, so I think I better do at least Shards of Honor, maybe the first one or two books in the main sequence, the Vorkosigan saga, to see if I want to carry on. But, you know, I enjoyed this book, so as long as it's this competently written and the story is this interesting, or at least logical, and the themes are as strong as this, I think I'll probably enjoy Shards of Honor. Next up in the SFBRP, the next book that I'm going to be reviewing is a collection of stories called Manhattan in Reverse, by Peter F. Hamilton, and then I'll be doing the World War series by Harry Turtledove, talking about that series, because I'm listening to World War in the Balance again as we speak. I'm most of the way through that. We'll do the Solaris podcast. I'll do that with Juliana at some point in the next month or so. And also, if people are interested, I was thinking of doing an in-depth talk about my own novels called Minding Tomorrow, Combat, Get That Rat Off My Face, and the other book in that series, which, to be honest, my own book, I've completely... Oh, Broken Glass as well, which is the last book in that series, with those four novels kind of make up a unit. And I thought of doing... Because I've mentioned them many times before, but I've... And there's been a review by somebody else. It was a guest reviewer, did a review of Minding Tomorrow many years ago. And I thought, well, enough time has passed. If you're going to read them, you'd have read them already. So I thought me and Juliana could do a total spoiler review and talk about and discussion about the series. And I'll get into all of the different ideas that are in the books and why I added in these kind of stuff, and a bit of behind the scenes of those novels as well. So if you're interested in that, email me, luke@juggler.net, or send me a message on goodreads.com. I'm Luke Burridge on there. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, we'll do that in the future. I'll read back over the novels again. I'll get Juliana to read at least the first book, Mining Tomorrow, and I'll do that kind of stuff. If you're interested in learning or finding out about what I think about my own novels, in a critical way, I can be just as critical of them as I am about other books, and also discover, blah 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 stuff. Anyway, that's it for me. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. I'm not posting up there very much recently, but I'm enjoying Twitter. I enjoy reading Twitter. I don't post too much there, so you can check that out. Best thing to do, though, if you're interested in what I'm up to reading wise, is follow me or become my friend on goodreads.com. I also really enjoy reading what other people think about the same book that I've just read. I would do it, but I don't have internet connection at the moment, so I don't have that Goodreads page up. I think Falling Free and this whole Vorkosigan saga is very popular with many, many listeners to the Science Fiction Book Review podcast. So that's what I gathered just by my quick little bit of research there on goodreads.com that I did a few days ago. Otherwise, that's it for me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.